Okay, folks, it's 3 o'clock. Thank you. Please take a seat. All right, so Tammy, it will be, we'll make 35 minutes, and then just as a friendly reminder to my colleagues is we speak slowly, thank you, Jane, and then also, you know, we're rapidly approaching the 5 o'clock based on the amount of time, some of the question, and also we do have, we will have public comments at the end of the day on the 6.0 topic, and in fairness, we don't want to shorten those folks either. So I'm asking all of us collectively, you know, to discipline ourselves with our time. So, Norm?
Great.
We're going to move on to the next panel, which is going to talk about data management, and I think it's incredible that I'm not the one speaking today, and my voice continues to get worse. We're going to have 35 minutes for the five panelists. They're going to introduce themselves. We're going to move through this as quickly as possible because we do have another panel after this, and we'll make sure we have enough time for the public comment at the end. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm Claire Weinman with the Grower Shipper Association of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo Counties.
Thank you. I'm Sarah Lopez with Central Coast Water Quality Preservation, Inc.
Harry Clausen, Central Coast Groundwater Coalition.
George Adam, Innovative Produce and Santa Maria Vegetable Grower.
Tim Burrell with Blanco Farms.
And as mentioned, today we'll be speaking with you on generating meaningful data and balancing the level of detail with the reporting burden. The theme for this panel actually came from the East San Joaquin Order footnote 88. And it's a very extensive paragraph, but we have a few excerpts for you today here, which is that the regional water boards have the flexibility to develop alternative reporting areas as long as it provides meaningful data and balances the level of detail with the reporting burden. So what we'd like to impress upon you today is that data precision, quality, and accuracy are of the utmost importance. And we recognize the need to report data. We need to make sure that the reporting requirements for Ag Order 4.0 are workable for growers, meaningful, and can be implemented on the Central Coast. We would like to speak about the relationship between data and reporting and what growers and the Regional Water Board can do to demonstrate quantifiable progress in improving water quality in Central Coast irrigated lands.
Okay, we certainly all recognize the Regional Water Board's mandate or your charter to protect beneficial uses. And in many cases where we have surface and groundwater that are degraded and are not meeting those standards, we certainly have a shared goal of improving water quality. And when it comes to our position as growers and applicators, what our goal is to minimize further impact in the future, any further impairment, and where we can improve this existing water quality. In surface water, it's a very quick reaction. Groundwater, it's a much slower reaction. And we'll talk about a little bit here later what those groundwater impact improvements or improvements for the impact could be. So you do have discretion from the East San Joaquin Order. It does recognize, the State Board did recognize, Central Coast is different. As you heard earlier today, we have very different cropping patterns, very much more intensive in timing. You know that quite well. These multiple locations, multiple crops, same location within a single year. And then we have the unpredictability of the markets and other factors that can cause us to not harvest, or even different types of crops that we have within those fields that may be different throughout the year. So what the State Board order does do is encourages meaningful data and a balance of the level of data with the reporting burden. So what is it that we are going to be reporting that's going to be useful for you meeting your mandate? Okay, the other part of this flow chart I want to talk about, this is talking about groundwater in particular. The goal, of course, is to improve groundwater quality, protect and meet the water quality standards that we have. And we want to collect meaningful data where that will be useful. The reporting of the nitrogen applied, the total nitrogen applied, and the crop removed certainly can benefit to that. And then at some point, once we have this data, and we've got have 2 years of good data to start with, 3 years actually, we want to accurately identify these potential outliers. Now, we're still working on that in the Central Valley on the best way to define what an outlier is, but we do know from looking at the charts now that there's clearly individuals, at least with the data that was turned in, are they're an outlier based on what the standards are, application standards developed by the university and otherwise. And once we have that information and have identified those outliers, we're going to begin the outreach and assistance to those outliers. Notification and understanding that you're in that position, of course, is the first step to making improvements.
So as we're discussing data management and reporting, we wanted to speak briefly on the context of current enrollment in the Central Coast Ag Order. Enrollment is certainly a moving target as people are adding and removing branches, but to the best of our knowledge, the information here is accurate based on ENOI enrollment information from this summer. So what we see is that almost two-thirds of irrigated acres on the Central Coast are growing row crops. And with that often comes issues like we talked about, the multiple plantings and crops throughout the year, operators moving on and off ranches, and diversity in the ranches and operations throughout Region 3. If we look at the enrollment information in a little bit more detail, we see that almost 70% of ranches in Region 3 are less than 100 acres in size, with a minimum of 0.2 acres and a maximum of just under 2,800. So as we consider this enrollment context, we're asking for Ag Order 4.0 to set up a nitrogen reporting structure that works for the dynamic Central Coast row crops, the diversity of operations and ranches, and the operator movement throughout the year. So as we look at the number, you can see the median ranch acres for row crops is 70 acres. For vineyards, that's 40.
Okay, and in terms of data, we prefer to have obviously usable data for meaningful analysis. It's been mentioned already today that growers generally deal in what's applied, what's removed, what the crop uptake is. A very important part when you get around to talking about outliers is comparing apples to apples. Growers prefer to be compared to their peer groups, if you will, and you've heard a little bit about that, about the sub-basins within the valley. And also the climatic regions, growers would prefer to be compared to their peers in their region. As a multi-sub basin grower, I can tell you that we would prefer our ranches in one area to be compared to those. Even though we're not isolated to just that area, we would prefer to be compared to our neighbors in the sense that they face the same challenges there, and they're very different. So comparing similar ranches is a way to say that. We like manageable data points and reporting requirements that are intuitive and reasonable. In the terms that I've mentioned before today, that the grower works in would be best for agriculture. And that also we recognize that, and it happens to us as well as you and your staff, that personnel changes. And that with the simplicity, if it can be achieved, it makes it easier to transfer something to someone new within your organization. We've seen it in our own operations, and as consultants come and go, employees come and go, it's very hard if something's complex to bring someone up to speed when you cannot find people within the workforce that have this whole suite of talent that can deal with, you know, what we're trying to accomplish via compliance. And so we'd prefer regulations that are possible to achieve compliance. And obviously, we want to always consider the social, technical, and economic constraints.
Okay, moving on to the data points. And the as far as growers working with the number of data points to get to this applied and removed number, which has been proposed, which I'm very much against because of all the complicating factors you're going to have in even keeping that data, and then the ultimate irrelevance of that data due to the differences in, I mean, this is just a small list of operations, you know, the different timings of how crops are cultivated, rain events, and the huge number of variability of practices. Rather than focusing on just those practices, rather than a applied and removed, which I've seen in other parts of the world, but in this area where we have so many different diversions, you don't have a lot of field crops and tree crops, which have very deep-rooted systems where something like this might be appropriate. But when you have crop types, we have different varieties. They take huge differences in fertilizer that we've seen. I mean, just that alone would make much of the data irrelevant. And really, to be able to move the needle at all, this is going to take a huge amount of investment, and it's going to yield very little. If you took at the planting times of the year, you're going early and late. There's economic decisions that are made that none of this is going to take into consideration, and we have to be profitable. And I think focusing more on practices rather than keeping all this huge number of this huge amount of applied and removed data is just going to be an incredible time and money pit that's not going to yield much at all. And I mean, you just saw the numbers on ranches. You know, you're going to have these smaller ranches anywhere near equipped to be able to do that, and I think we all know the answer to that. And I think that's basically all I have to say.
And so in terms of that and a little bit more specifics, with the precedential aspects of the Eastern San Joaquin Order, we're expecting nitrogen applied and removed data for 420,000 acres, 4,300 ranches, and about 1,650 operations. And there's a lot of underlying data that goes into generating the summary numbers that are reported to the Water Board. In terms of a little bit more specifics for the 2016 TNA, the total nitrogen applied reporting, that was required only, as you may recall, for a subset of the Tier 2 and Tier 3 ranches. It was less than 23% of the enrolled acres and 14% of total enrolled ranches. But that number generated over 45,000 data values that were reported on that set of data just for that 1 year for that subset of growers. So when we look forward to the 2017 TNA reporting, that was after it was expanded to all Tier 2 and Tier 3 ranches. We're not aware if that information is available yet. It was my understanding that information is still pending, still being processed. And on that 2017 TNA form, there were over 200 crop variations. Some of them were duplicates of the other. But every time that you introduce more steps, it means more opportunities for error, even though there's a good faith effort on the part of the growers to comply and to report that accurate information. So our ask for 4.0 is to have a reporting structure that's set up so that growers can succeed in reporting accurate information, that they have a fair shot at submitting information that's accurate, and that it's the basis for accurately identifying true outliers and making sure that when we look at that 2015 to the 2016 graph, that making sure that that wasn't just somebody who reported their total pounds of fertilizer, not total pounds of nitrogen. And so as we're looking at structuring exactly what we're asking people to report, again, we ask that we're mindful of the reporting structure so that we can submit accurate information and be successful in identifying outliers in need of outreach and assistance.
As far as prioritizing finite resources, I think the question's still open. WDR versus waiver, and agriculture is more than willing to have that discussion. But for the sake of this slide, I think the second and third point, they go together as well as do the last three. I think when we talk about the ability to understand the requirements, let the grower understand what he has to do, and he has a clear and easy way to report that. I think more complexity is going to yield a longer time frame for growers to get proficient in doing it. If it's easy to report correctly, it'll allow less time for the staff to go around chasing people who weren't good at doing it. So simplicity will be the key in the reporting structure that's developed for 4.0. Also, at the last three points, we are dealing with a lack of resources that you've heard about of how to achieve what we're trying to do. That also goes for consultants, CCAs, if there's been some outcry that if the CCAs are liable for the recommendations they make on fertilizer, that it's a deal breaker for them. I think what we need to do is be able to rely on them, but we also don't want to drive them away with too complex a regulation.
This next portion, I think, is really the tipping point where we can make a difference in this whole issue as far as nitrogen in the groundwater. If we incentivize rather than penalize the use of existing nitrates in the groundwater through a pump and fertilize, really fine-tuning that, then we can move that box that was presented earlier on the new nitrogen. We can make that box move to the left and in a significant way. And until we do that, I don't see that happening. And I'll give you some reasons as to why I feel so strongly about that. First of all, we had a concept where using that nitrogen in soil prep, whether it be, even in seed, anytime you're applying high nitrate waters to the soil, it has the chance of it hanging on so that the roots can grow into it. So the more of that you can do, the better off it's going to be anytime. It should not be viewed as a pollutant as it is pre-existing. It's not really impacting the existing groundwater other than helping it consume the pre-existing nitrate. The other thing is if you could bring it from the higher nitrate regions are generally closer to the surface, more in the first encounter groundwater, and so it would keep high nitrate water from migrating into the areas where you would more likely draw it up for municipal use. So basically more conjunctively use the basin so that you would keep all of the agriculture operations to the extent possible in the upper stratas and conserve those lower levels where you have drinking water quality or closer to drinking water quality available for use in that application, and only using that for ag purposes where needed, where low salt or low nitrogen applications are needed. And so you have those, you'd have a conjunctively used basin. If we can get together on that type of concept and have reporting that would incentivize that type of management, then we could significantly make a change here. But until that happens, I think you're just going to see accumulation. But that's my opinion on that, and I think most growers would agree with that. The multi-crop diversity on the Central Coast, another big thing that necessitates the ability for the grower to have that management is that some crops are very good at feeding, other crops are not. Some are salt sensitive, some are not. And so that multi-cropping plan needs to be managed by the grower so that he has good economic outcomes. The reporting has to be conducive to accuracy, and that's really managing what is reported and making it reasonable. Because the more unreasonable you make it, the more inaccurate it's likely to be. I mean, you think about it, every hour that you spend reporting is an hour that they don't spend out managing, really managing their irrigation uniformity. Because really that's what a lot of this is making sure that your sprinklers are having the best pattern possible and your drip systems are in the best pattern possible. And, that's something that there's never enough time in the day for. But, we do, everyone does the best they can. Flexibility that recognizes dynamic cropping systems, I already went through that, allows the adaptability in a crop type and reporting scale. And I think main thing is we need to have a system that rewards the use of that pre-existing nitrate.
Expound upon that a little bit. What do you mean by incentivize and give an example?
Well, if we just focus on the amount of new nitrate and you can look at the irrigation water, but it really should be given as a freebie, and therefore it would incentivize in no way, shape, or form should you ever penalize the use of that pre-existing nitrate. And that's been a common thread up to this point in regulation, as I've seen it. If you're reporting it, I mean, to me, I don't even think it should be reported. You should be incentivized for using the highest nitrate possible.
And the incentive would be what?
Not having to report it would be, I mean, in my mind, that would be ideal, but it should not be counted in any kind of a nitrogen budget.
So sure. If we did that, I understand you got nitrate in water, and I appreciated this from this morning's presentation, where there are times when the application of water doesn't need any nitrate in it because you're pre-soaking or germinating. But there is nitrate in it. So if we only focused on new nitrate, which was being applied later, can we still push this towards improving water quality in the receiving waters?
Okay, that's a good example. In my opinion, which may have been differing from the previous, I guess they want to split it up because they didn't really want to throw, that we're just trying to work our way into this. But in the best case scenario, you should never penalize that, because if you have a heavy soil and you're applying any kind of that nitrate, it's going to have a likelihood to hang around until a root has a chance to pick it up. And anytime you do that, you're bettering the water quality. So anytime you can use it, you should do it. The reason that a lot of growers won't do it is because it is high salt at times. So if you're raising a salt-sensitive crop, then maybe they're going to say, well, maybe I don't want to do that right at the beginning of a crop, but they may want to finish the crop off with it. When you're pre-irrigating for soil condition, a lot of times you don't want to be loading a whole lot of salt. So there is that dynamic.
And if I may direct your attention, we did submit a letter earlier in the week on specifically on this issue, on the utilization of high nitrate irrigation water. And I think we don't want the situation. We included the language from the State Water Board on the ESJ order and why that's problematic. And we don't want to create a situation where if you have a well that's 300 parts per million nitrate, that you're never going to want to use that, because you're always going to be identified as an outlier. Or if you add any amount of fertilizer as a part of your program, that you would be penalized, and there's going to be situations where that wouldn't work. And so this is a very, very important issue to us. It's one of our main issues, but I also want to be mindful of making sure that we get to hear the rest of what Perry and Sarah have to say, and if time permits, we'd very much like to revisit this.
Please continue.
Okay, so there is one part of the state board order that you can relax about, and that's the domestic well testing. The Central Coast is way ahead of the Central Valley on domestic well testing and notification of the users. So we think that that's certainly a success story on the Central Coast. I know, speaking for the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition, 100% of our members notified the residents. In 2.0, 3.0, all the wells that have come back positive, they've been notified. And if it's a new well, existing well that was already above, they've been notified again. So the other thing that we want to talk about, though, or think about in 4.0 is we need to rationalize this further domestic well monitoring. If you've got a well that's 30, standards 10, and you've got 30, 40, why are we sampling this well year after year, mandating that a grower go back and test that well? If they're willing to commit to notification continually on an annual basis, then it's a place that we could have growers drop the sampling of their domestic wells. There's really no reason why they need to be sampling high domestic wells. We just know that in the experience from the last 3 or 4 years that growers are committed to implementing the notification, and they will continue to do that in 4.0, I'm sure. Certain areas, we're reaching out now to the non-ag wells in the Salinas Basin with the project you're familiar with. That's what the poster is up there. We're continuing that work in that area. So I want to switch to surface water monitoring. And Sarah.
Terry, can I? I know we're short on time. Just clarify one thing that you just said. You're saying once a well exceeds, then we don't need to worry about it because you're going to give them free water.
No, in the Salinas Valley, yes. But what I'm saying, why continue sampling that well? So right now the mandate is sample in 3.0, it's twice in 2017. Central Coast members were able to, Groundwater Coalition was twice over the four-year period. So in 4.0, let's figure out a way when the wells are above a certain level, stop monitoring, just make sure the notification stays in place. And growers have been doing that for decades already, many of them in these high nitrate areas. They have RO systems. That's already worked into their normal business patterns.
Well, I think I could agree with you if I could see that what you're describing is that they're treating their drinking water wells in the manner you just described. That would be one thing, but that's not what our data is showing. We still see people unaware of high exceedances. And so you're saying once that well is identified, then
the grower continues on an annual basis to notify them. They do the postings. They do the practices that they're doing in right now. They just don't need to go back and sample that well every year to show that it's still above the standard.
Okay. Might not agree.
Okay.
I'd try to reach the mic here. Sarah Lopez with Preservation, Inc. So this slide is just to give a couple of take-home points first. First of all, as we look for water quality improvements going into Ag Order 4.0, we need to look at both concentrations and loads, and we need to look at that in relation to water body characteristics like hydrology. Secondly, we just wanted to stress the importance of using the CMP data as the basis for assessing surface water quality for Ag Order 4.0 development. When it comes to toxicity, we have the impression that data from other programs is driving the discussion. And while it's appropriate to use that data, there was some real genius in the way Karen Worcester and others designed the CMP, and that data set in its entirety needs to be the go-to for Ag Order 4.0 development. This slide deals with a phenomenon that is inconvenient for the way water quality regulation is structured, but it is as real as gravity, and we're going to have to find a way to deal with it. When it comes to numeric water quality objectives, compliance is a binary and concentration-based concept. At 10.1 ppm of nitrate, we're out of compliance. At 9.9 ppm, we're in. And that's an easy concept to get our heads around. It's easy to display in a graph. It's easy to put on a map. That was also the information that told us in 2004 that an Ag Order program was needed, but it's not the right information to tell us how the program is working. The right information for that job is trends and patterns, and I left my dictionary at home today, so we're using the words trends and patterns somewhat interchangeably and in a more intuitive sense. And that's what we need to be looking at in developing Ag Order 4.0. The CMP was designed to detect trends, and indeed it does, so that's good news. We have the ability to detect change, to detect improvements, and to determine compliance. So that's the good news. But now we need to ask the question, is the water trending into compliance? That's what we want to know, right? And this is where, inconveniently, 13 and a half years of water quality data are telling us that change, improvement, and compliance, while detectable, don't look the way we expected them to. What is changing the most detectably is stream flow. On the Central Coast, we have so many water bodies for which effluent is a major component or the only component of the stream flow that when discharges are controlled or eliminated, stream flow changes or is eliminated. Trends in flow are what it looks like when Central Coast farmers better manage their discharge. What's improving most detectably on the Central Coast is loading. I grew up on the Chesapeake Bay, and pollutant loads to the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries mix with naturally occurring stream flow. So in the Chesapeake Bay, when pollutant loading is reduced, concentrations go down. They trend into compliance. On the Central Coast, when pollutant loads go down, we can measure that, but the concentration remains reflective of the remaining effluent because it's not mixing with naturally occurring stream flow. So this brings me back to the idea of binary compliance with concentration-based numeric objectives. A farm discharging to a dry Natividad Creek channel is no more likely to comply with these objectives than is a Lompoc wastewater treatment plant when it discharges to a dry Santa Ynez riverbed. Compliance in those cases looks like a dry stream. And this is something to keep in mind as we discuss how growers and the water board can manage riparian habitat. This slide deals with monitoring study design and what inferences can be drawn from the data. The rocket science in water quality is not in the analytical chemistry. It's in when and where you take your samples and how you draw appropriate inference from the results, neither over or under interpreting them. In May in Santa Barbara, you heard presentations from myself and also from the DPR, from Granite Canyon Lab, and from your own CCAMP staff. And I'd first just like to say that these are all excellent programs, and I consider them colleagues and mentors, and I agree with the findings of their studies. And when I look at Preservation Inc. And the CMP data, if I perform an analysis on that data similar to the way CCAMP analyzes its data, or I look at the same water bodies as a DPR or a Granite Canyon study, all of our programs tend to corroborate each other's findings, and I think it's really nice that the data agree in that way. But how do each of these inform Ag Order 4.0? The CCAMP program, for example, is the only one from which you can draw inference about the entire Central Coast, both impaired and unimpaired water bodies, reflective of all land uses. The appropriate program from which to draw inference about the scope of agricultural impairments is the CMP. The CMP study design is already constrained to impaired water bodies in agricultural areas. Other studies further constrain their sites to only the most highly impaired water, and they often go on to further constrain the discussion to only those samples in which pesticides or toxicity was detected. Almost done here. So this is appropriate if you're asking the question, how bad does it get, or what does the worst case scenario look like? But for Ag Order 4.0 development, those are not the most important questions. We need to know, what is the geographic extent of ag water quality impairment across the region? Which ag areas show impairment? And just as importantly, which don't, and why don't they? Are there improvements, and where are they occurring? To solve this problem, you have to understand it, and the program designed to help both the water board and the growers understand it is the CMP. So if you ignore the unimpaired ag areas or the samples that show non-detects for pesticide classes, you mischaracterize the problem. And if you do that, you can't tell if the ag order is working or how to make it better or even if it needs to be better. So as we work on Ag Order 4.0, let's base our assessments on the full data set from the program that was designed for the Central Coast Ag Order. Thank you.
And again, just in closing, we'd like to reemphasize again that data precision, accuracy, and quality are of the utmost importance, that the Ag Order 4.0 reporting structure should be set up so that growers can succeed in reporting accurate information that works in dynamic Central Coast row crops, diversity and operations and ranches, and operator movement, and that we recognize the need to report data and want to make sure that reporting requirements are workable for growers, meaningful, and can be implemented on the Central Coast. And we look forward to bringing forward more specific solutions in the coming months. Thank you.
Thank you, team. And I will start on my left, Delgado.
All right, Sarah, thank you. You make really good logical points, and they conflict in my mind with those maps we keep being shown about those lower three rivers having such a high concentration of high exceedances. So how do I, as a board member, how do I bring those two seemingly conflicting bodies of information together? You telling me that if we look at the whole data set, things are getting better versus those maps we keep seeing, showing toxicity, nitrate, sedimentation, et cetera, being at crucial levels in these lower rivers, Pajaros, Santa Maria, and Salinas.
If it's all right with you, I'm going to pass the mic to George, and then I'll come back and address your question.
Sure. Okay.
You know, what we've seen is the repeated use of just looking at the nitrate aspect first, or just solely the nitrate aspect. If you pump and then repump the water, you have an accumulation as it moves through the basin. So if you're not withdrawing that up and recycling that nitrate, you're just going to have an increasing concentration as it moves through the underground as you near the coast. And that's why generally, just as a general point, you don't see it in the upper watersheds as much.
Or maybe another way of thinking that, is that the direction of groundwater movement and flow tends to be towards the mouth of these basins. And that's why you oftentimes see the concentration. And going back to one of the previous panels, that's why sometimes there are these kind of narrative objectives, because it recognizes the difficulty of achieving some of the numeric water quality standards, as opposed to having kind of narrative and iterative improvements in the process.
So are the lower watersheds getting better in nitrates, both surface water and groundwater, in your opinions, or are they not?
What in my discussions, as far as these nitrate, where we use in those wells where you use the highest nitrate and you go to that and you use it as a function of your fertilizing. And I wanted to clarify, we use that in the farm's nitrate budget, but the board should not use it against us in our budget. But when I said we would use it in our budget, but it should not be, we shouldn't be penalized for doing so. So yes, where we've seen that repeatedly, where if you pump on those high nitrate wells significantly and you use them in your nitrate budget in those crops in that area, we've seen improvement.
And then so I guess my two cents would be, to some extent, I think your question kind of makes my point, which is that when you look at concentration-based water quality objectives, which I recognize is your charge to bring these water bodies in compliance with those numeric objectives, when the problem is, I think what we're seeing is that's kind of a clunky mechanism for evaluating whether or not the ag order is resulting in growers reducing or eliminating discharges, because the changes to water quality that result from those activities on the land don't necessarily improve the concentrations, except in water bodies that have naturally occurring stream flow. So, for example, in my presentation back in Santa Barbara, there was a green dot on the map in the Salinas River at Greenfield. And that's a monitoring station that receives inputs from a lot of different tributaries in the agricultural areas of the Salinas Valley. But when we do manage to monitor that site, it's because there are these pristine base flows coming from dam releases at the top of the watershed. And so the discharges mix with those base flows, and it results in a low concentration. And as growers reduce their discharges into the tributaries, we will see it as, increasing amounts of green dots in the main stem rivers. The problem is those tributaries, which are also water bodies of the state that we monitor for this program, don't have the benefit of that, of a dam release or a naturally occurring stream flow in some cases. And so when you eliminate one discharge to what would otherwise be a dry creek bed, whatever else you monitor there is going to be a reflection of the remaining effluent, not a reduced concentration because you have less effluent mixing with the base flow. Does that make...
I understand your points, yeah.
Okay.
All right, so we're moving along. Mr. Young?
Thank you guys, for the exchange. I appreciate it. And I'm intrigued, George, by the conjunctive use concept. And I'm just wondering, is there enough volume of water in the upper aquifers to satisfy ag's need?
Right, and one thing that we need to be clear on so that I don't get shot by the rest of the growing community is that that nitrate is only available in a very small percentage relative to the quote-unquote new nitrate. And that's where, you know, the regulator said, oh, there's a, you know, there's X number of pounds in here, so you can just get that, you know, one-to-one. It doesn't work that way. Well, because of the competitive uptake of the salt, and, you know, you're salting the soil, and the fact that you put it on and it went past the root zone in your pre-irrigation, there's all kinds of issues as to why that is not a one-to-one ratio. So that's why when a regulator comes in and says, well, you got, you know, you're putting on 50 pounds here, what's the point, you know? Well, you may be only getting 5 pounds out of that 50 pounds. You may be getting, you know, 25 pounds out of that 50 pounds. There's a lot of variables that go into that.
Because we've heard that there's the bulk of that is available. I think that's what's been presented to us.
Right, and that's not true in my mind. And you ask any grower, yeah, you go do that. It doesn't work the same.
Okay.
We need to be perfectly clear on that, or I'm going to get shot by every grower I know.
Okay.
The other thing that I wanted to add, too, is that, you know, when there is the discussion of EC, there's some crops that are more salt sensitive or that are more salt sensitive than others. And so there's certain crops like lettuce and strawberries that are very salt sensitive and would get burned by, like, literally, it literally looks like it got sunburned by the salts in that water. And so there would be kind of some vegetable crops like broccoli that might be able to better tolerate the accompanying salts with that high nitrate. And then there's other crops that it's just not agronomically feasible or doesn't have the same feasibility of implementation of that practice in that situation.
Okay. Perry, your comment actually to something Monica was concerned about, and I just want to weigh in on it, and that's about not sampling wells once they've been determined to be, you know, exceeding limits, and then, you know, supplemental water is being provided to residences. In my mind, my model is we need to continue monitoring those wells because they're telling us how that basin is doing. And to me, that's the direct connection to the beneficial use. It's in that aquifer. And so the whole issue of, you know, supplying supplemental water and that huge need is secondary to the impact to the beneficial use directly. I mean, it's a significant consequence, and we have to do what we're doing to remediate that. We have to get water, clean water to people to drink. But I don't see backing off that particular kind of monitoring as being helpful to what we want to see happen, and that is the recovery of that basin.
Let me just comment real quickly. We're out of time. Is that if you use that data to do a trend monitoring or characterization of watershed, that's one thing. We're not doing that. We're just sampling a zillion wells, sending in the data, and it's sitting in a database. So what you say is true. If you had a scientifically designed trend monitoring where you're tracking certain areas, yes, you're going to answer the question you just said. But what we're doing now is we're shooting a shotgun out into this Central Coast area, and there's all those data points, and you have no answer to the question, is it getting better or worse? So that's why I'm saying if there was a reason why you were doing that domestic well repeat, then that's one thing. But what we're doing now is just making growers go out, resample their well for something they already know exists.
Are you suggesting that then we should shift towards a monitoring program that will really tell us about trends and then potentially ramping up the amount of monitoring so that we have enough data points that we can say we've got a fairly good trend going on?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we've got so many data points, but we're not doing anything with them. We just have them sitting in a database. The statement you made, I want to know if the water quality is getting better or worse, we're not doing that. Your staff's not doing that. We're not doing that. We're just collecting data. It's going in a database.
But the data is there. It just hasn't been analyzed.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Dr. Hunter?
I'll go along with Mr. Young's follow-up to my question, but I would add to that that prior to the current regime of well monitoring in ag areas, we had no data. And I think, you know, a consideration here is that how much data is required to start to understand trends and patterns. I think we're barely there. I think there is potential, but without that data, we have no standing to even begin to think of what it would look like, what it would cost, who should do it, et cetera. So I see the value in data serving several purposes, that being a priority as far as the larger ag program. But in terms of identifying the need for replacement water, which is, to my mind, an onerous way of living, I don't see that as being any sort of a solution except for health reducing health impacts directly. But I do believe that the data that set that we're building and that will continue to show, potentially those wells are going to improve, and how would we know? We wouldn't. So I think the practices that are being implemented, whether through pilot research projects or through coordination of sub-basin growers that have a relationship for similar, as Tim was pointing out, similar location or similar crop types. Those are factors that I'm hearing about and learning about from you all. I've gone out and seen for myself and been totally overwhelmed with seeing, you know, row after row of different colors and knowing that those are different crops. But I don't think reducing the amount of data we're collecting right now is going to take us to a place where we can actually begin to do that trend and pattern analysis. So that's why I said I'm not sure I agree. I'm open, however, to other pathways to produce the trends and patterns that we want to see to tell us, you know, is what we're doing collectively overall improving the groundwater basins.
We're committed to helping you develop that monitoring plan.
Yeah, you have.
In 4.0.
You've played a big part in establishing it. So I'll just let it go there. Thank you. Thank you all for your presentation today.
Ms. Gray?
Okay, so I won't let it go, though, because I do think it's an important point. I don't mean to pile on or belabor it, but I'll speak slower. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry. But I think, you know, you have been a tremendous resource in compiling the data, and I think we are compiling the data. We're setting a baseline, and it's important. Maybe we need to shift from annual to every other year, or maybe there are some opportunities to do that. But I think, you know, this data is extremely valuable, and I think that we are in the process of moving through it and analyzing it. So that's number one. And then, George, I know this disincentive thing has been a big issue with you for a while. You've talked about it for a couple years, and I appreciate it. And I'm always interested in seeing things incentivized. So, you know, I'd like to know from you, without getting shot, clearly, if we're incentivizing you to use it, then there is some bioavailability. And I recognize, you know, that that's a complex blend. But, you know, if we want to incentivize that, then it's got to be recognized that there is bioavailability, and we've got to figure out how that works with different soil types and different crops, right?
Right. I think that's really what needs to be studied, if there's some money that needs to go into something, because at least you get an asset back. I mean, basically, nitrogen is energy at the end of the day, and if you're going to make that available, you're conserving energy. So I would think that there'd be money available to do that. But
yeah, let's get the right cocktail.
You know,
down.
We're just the growers at trial and error stuff. So, you know. Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson?
The advantage of going last is I get to listen to the answers to all my questions without even having to ask them.
Ooh, I'm impressed. So I think, you know, the topic about, you know, testing and what we're going to do with it as we move in later months in further discussing you know, what potentially could be in an order. These will be item, you know, that we can further analyze and reflect on. I have to say that myself, you know, if somebody asked me to do something in reporting, I'd like to know what is being done with it and that something be done with it. There's nothing more frustrating than submitting information and it end up in a big black hole. And I'm not referring specifically to the Regional Water Board, but, you know, my own experience, my own business, I have a lot of reporting to do to other agencies, and sometimes I wonder, what the heck do they do with it? They never give me feedback. So I get that point. But I have one simple question. That was on the slide regarding prioritization, finite resource. You had one bullet point, which we kind of went through real quick, called possible role of coalitions and third parties. I know, you know, we're running out of time, but I think that's a big topic. And, you know, I know we don't have the time, but I would like down the road to get that particular bullet item augmented, because I think there's a lot of good example of the value of third party and coalitions, both here on the Central Coast and in the Central Valley. So I'd love to see more time spent on that, but because of you know, our time right now, probably don't have, we can't engage in that, but I just wanted to bring it back to the surface and capitalize and underline that item. So in future months, I would love to, you know, get collaboratively your thoughts on leveraging third party and coalitions. So thank you so much. Great job. Appreciate. Norm,